Well, welcome back to the program. I'm Betsy Rosenberg, and I am very pleased and honored to have my next guest join us. Dr. Mary Pfeiffer is a therapist, a writer, a speaker, a best-selling author. You may recall the book Reviving Ophelia. This book is about reviving ourselves and our capsized culture. That is the tagline on the book just out, The Green Boat. And as soon as I heard about it, I had to have her on the show, and really pleased you could find time in your very busy schedule. You do a lot, and I just mentioned a few of your titles. You're also an active member of the Grandmother's Apple Pie Brigade. Well, we want to hear about all that and more, and we have time to chat about 20 minutes. I'm really looking forward to digging in with you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Betsy. I'm happy to be on.
I'm not finished with your book yet, but I can't put it down at the same time. It's wonderful. It's so timely. What prompted you to write this particular book? I know you've got, at least 8 or 9 books under your belt?
Yeah, The Green Boat's my 9th book, and actually I write all my books for the same reason, which is that I'm really struggling to understand something that the culture isn't offering very good answers to. And in this case, I was very aware of the enormous gap between the science, the IPCC, for example, reports, and the way individual people and governments were responding to that news. And since I come from a therapist background, I started thinking about those issues in terms of resistance and denial. And I wanted to explore the psychological issues that keep us from dealing with it. But the other thing is, I felt traumatized myself by the information when I really came to understand what was happening to our planet. I was very upset by it. I have grandchildren. I have great love of Mother Earth and all aspects of Mother Earth. And I realized that for my own sake, for my own mental health, I needed to be intensely engaged in saving the Earth in order to be happy. There was no way I could ignore this kind of information and have the kind of authentic, integrated life I wanted. So in addition to writing, I became very involved as an activist. And The Green Boat is both writing about the psychology of the situation and also about what happens when you decide to become deeply engaged with the issues as opposed to just feel badly about them or try not to think about them.
So you say that once you were aware of what was going on with our environment, with our climate, you could not ignore it. How come so many Americans in particular seem to be to have that capacity to ignore it or minimize it and go about their daily lives?
Well, you know, there's the usual explanations, which have to do with the fact that the media doesn't cover this well at all, as you just mentioned with your former speaker, and also with the fact that in this country there's a deliberate misinformation campaign designed to obfuscate the issues. So those things play a small role in it. But actually, I really believe the main reason people aren't dealing well with this information is very traumatic information with overwhelming implications. And it's so hard to really accept it emotionally and start working with it and adapting to it and then responding to it in a resilient way that I think without more help than most of us get and better leadership, it's very hard to know what to do. I mean, of course, we all know to recycle and ride our bicycles and try to drive fuel-efficient cars. I mean, there's a standard list. And I don't want to minimize that. In fact, one thing I often do when I'm talking to people is say, they'll say, well, I don't feel like I'm doing anything. And I'll go, well, let's talk about what you're doing. And most people that are intelligent actually can list real quickly 15, 20 things they're already doing. So people are, for the most part, doing many of those very good things, if they can. But I also think that we need to do more, and that more generally involves acting in groups and in communities. You know, small groups throughout the history of the world have really been, I used to say the miracle grow for social change. Now I say the TerraCycle for social change. But that's what changes the world, is a group of people coming together and deciding to help each other deal with troubling information, to figure out a way to impact
their culture around that issue, like, for example, slavery or civil rights or the women's movement, and then going to work. So I'm a big believer that, you know, you have a group if you have one friend and sit down to have a cup of coffee and say, let's talk this over and make a plan. That's a group. And I'm a very big believer in that kind of group action.
And you've gotten involved in the group efforts in your community to fight the Keystone XL pipeline. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, once I'd had this moment of realization about how urgent and serious our situation was here on Mother Earth, I decided I was going to do something about it. And I invited a couple friends over, and we were talking about what we could do locally, because I always think it's good to act locally. That's where you know what the deal is. That's where you have friends to help you. That's where you have resources and connections you can utilize. And so anyway, I bought a bottle of nice wine, and we had a good dinner, and a couple people came over. And we just started kicking around different things in our state we might get involved with. Well, just at that time, TransCanada had announced they were going to have a pipeline from the tar sands in Alberta run across the Great Plains, crossing virtually every major river system in the Great Plains, and going over the Ogallala Aquifer in Nebraska and through our very fragile sandhills on its way to Texas, where that tar sands oil could be processed and sold on the world market.
And where were you living?
Nebraska. I was then, and I still
right
am,
there
living
in the line
right
of,
in the heart of
there.
The country, right on the route of the Keystone XL. So that was our issue. And we talked about it that night. We wanted to get some more people involved in our group. And we also wanted a lot more information than we had at that point. And so 2 weeks later, we had another meeting. And by the way, our meetings were fun. People are tired. They're overwhelmed. They have too much to do every day of their lives. And we figured out really early on that if we wanted people to be involved and stay with us, we needed to make this fun. So we met in private homes. We always had good food. We had a lot of laughter. And we created a lot of very fun ways to engage with the media and the citizens of our state to keep things on a positive and optimistic level for the most part.
For the most part. I'm sure there are moments, especially, you know, when you see research that shows still I think the majority of Americans are in favor of the Keystone pipeline being built, and yet if you really scratch beneath the surface, I would imagine that most of those people are not aware of some of the environmental and potential health impacts that could, you know, affect, if not them directly, you know, their neighboring communities or where relatives live.
Well, you know, one of the really interesting things, Betsy,
not to mention
was,
climate change, which affects everybody.
Right. But in this state, I'm kind of an urban progressive, I would call myself, and kind of tied in with the academic and psychology community here in Lincoln. And I was in a group with people like myself, and we are the royalty of lost causes in this state. I mean, this is the one of the reddest states in the union. We have no Democrats in higher office in this state, and haven't for a long time. The last time I believe we went for a Republican president was Eisenhower. So, I mean, for a Republican or a Democratic president was Truman. So it's a state that's very, very conservative. But the thing that was really interesting is our first allies in this fight to stop the Keystone XL were ranchers and farmers, because they understand water. And they understand that if your water's polluted, you're in big trouble. Our state is an agricultural state. The main thing we have in this state is water. We have that beautiful ancient Ogallala Aquifer that gives our farmers and ranchers fresh water. And those of us who live in the eastern part of the state, far from the sandhills, we drink that water. And if you want to appeal to people, there's probably no more basic appeal than you can make than do you want to drink clean water. And one of the things that we worked very hard on is we never framed the issues in ideological ways. We talked about water, we talked about land, we talked about safety. And those were issues that an amazing number of Nebraskans got very interested in, and we were actually stunned by our ability to sort of organize statewide movement to stop that Keystone XL. And so far, we've been very successful. I mean, it's now going on 3 years, and that Keystone XL has not been built, and a good part of the reason why is Nebraska.
And do you talk about climate change? And that should not be an ideological issue, shouldn't be a politicized issue, but of course it's become that, you know, because of
the I never talk to climate change deniers. It's a waste of time. I don't believe you can talk people out of an idea. You can't reason people out of an idea they didn't reason themselves into. And so I don't waste, in fact, one of the reasons I wrote The Green Boat is I really wanted to start a new conversation. That conversation about who does and doesn't believe in climate change and do more people believe in it now. And it's been an enormous diversion from dealing with climate change. And so in The Green Boat and in my own work here in Nebraska, I just leap right on over that issue. And my assumption is there's climate change. If people want information about that, I'm happy to direct them to very good scientific sources. But I like to work in this zone that has to do with cultural discussions, community engagement, direct action to influence public policy, and so on. And I don't really encourage anybody to spend time trying to convert climate change deniers. We can do so much more work that's important and profitable if we just avoid that particular kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm. And as is the case with those of us who perhaps sometimes obsessively focus on the ecological crises we're facing, when you see things like the Superstorm Sandy that hit almost a year ago, devastating parts of the East Coast, and waking up a lot of people to climate change's arrival on our shores, if Katrina didn't do that back in 2005, you know, what, I guess the question would be, when you see these extreme weather events, be they the fires, the droughts, the tornadoes, the twisters that have just been devastatingly destructive, for those of us who, quote, know too much, isn't it sometimes difficult when you hear members of the media calling this a natural disaster or just, you know, saying this is God's will, you know, and trying,
you know, again,
to point out
it's
that
very
it's
interesting.
Actually,
of course it's difficult. It's oh. difficult, and depending on your psychological bent, it makes you very sad or it makes you very angry. But, you know, that is one of the things, both with my writing and my activism, I don't tend to focus on what's difficult. I tend to focus on what works in helping people change. So, for example, when I think about the information we get from the culture, I divide it into two categories. And one of them I call distractional intelligence, which is all this information that makes us very stressed and upset and feel powerless and feel helpless and feel scared, but we don't know what to do with it. And that information is worse than of no use. It's worse than of no use because it, in fact, sends people deeper into denial, trauma, resistance, lethargy, depression, and so on. The information that's extraordinarily helpful to people is what I call actionable intelligence. And that is information that gives people an idea about what to do tomorrow in their own community. So, for example, with our group, we'd get together for a meeting and we'd exchange information relevant to our issue, the Keystone XL. And then by the end of the meeting, we didn't have any ain't it awful talk. We didn't have any, oh, isn't this bad news or whatever. By the end of the meeting, we would have an action plan for what we were going to do that month. And we tried to have, as I say, we tried to have action plans that we enjoyed. So you mentioned earlier, Betsy, the Apple Pie Brigade. One of our actions was a group of, I'm 65, a group of us, Nebraska, primarily grandmothers, but women my age. We went down to the governor's mansion every Monday at noon, and we took him muffins and apple pies and little gifts, and we wrote a thank you in advance letter to our governor for protecting our state from TransCanada and the Keystone XL pipeline. Now, the governor didn't come out and get those gifts. The security guard did. But then we'd walk over the Capitol building a block away, and we would ask for, very politely, a meeting with the governor. Now, he stalled us for quite a while, but eventually we were able to say, we deserve a meeting. We're constituents. And it was very shortly after that that the governor wrote President Obama a letter and said, we don't want this pipeline crossing our aquifer. Now, I don't know if we played a role
that.
In that.
I remember that.
I don't know if we played a role in that or not, but we felt we played a role in it. And we know from information that has since been revealed, Van Jones, who was high up in the White House at the time President Obama denied the pipeline permit, said this pipeline was a done deal until those folks in Nebraska stopped it. And he looked at it. I was in the audience when he said this, and he said, you people in Nebraska stopped that pipeline. And we were, I don't mean just my group. I mean, what happened was our group had information sessions. Other groups started. Pretty soon there were a lot of people all over this state working very hard in different ways in their areas. But the point I want to make to your listeners is this started with just ordinary citizens going, we want to look into this, and we want to work together to figure out a way to deal with it. You know, the crazy thing about this country is people think they're powerless. We're educated to believe that. And that belief that you're powerless becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because if you think you're powerless, you are. You won't act. You won't do what you need to do to protect yourself and your land. And on the other hand, what we learned was by getting together and deciding to act as if you have power, you actually create power. It's been an amazing experience, and it's been fun to be engaged in this three-year process of fighting to save our state, meeting all the people I've met. And it's also been fun to write about it in the Green Boat and help other people understand this can be done. This can really be done by almost anyone, anywhere. In fact, I noticed with your last person, you ask him, what can people do? And when someone asks me that, I always say, do what you want to do. Do what you love to do. We all have passions. We all have gifts. This very troubled planet needs your best energy, your best gifts, your greatest passion. So, for example, if you play a guitar, if you have web skills, if you can bake apple pies, if you have speaking skills, if you have writing skills, if you have conversational skills, there is a way to use those skills, particularly in conjunction with other people, to make something really powerful happen wherever you live.
Interesting observation about people feeling powerless. I've observed that myself. And yet, isn't it interesting, just if you look at American culture, you know, we're all about innovation, opportunity, you know, pulling yourself up and creating your future. You know, we're kind of empowered
right.
as individuals in this country, and that also is part of the problem, that we, you know, pride ourselves on our success as a country and our acquisition and our acquisitiveness and our materialism, and that's part of the problem. So why, when it comes to, you know, issues like this, although they are, yes, granted, global, but we certainly have a big footprint in the United States and, you know, should be showing more leadership in terms of beginning to turn the ship around, all of a sudden it's like we go limp when it comes to those kinds of things.
Well, first of all, we're not empowered in this country to be in charge of our fates politically. I mean, if you really believe, which I do, that the definition of democracy is that you have the power to influence decisions that affect your own life, we're not encouraged to take power to influence those decisions. And, you know, when people say you can exercise your power by voting, you can write to a congressman, believe me, I've done those kind of things all my life, and they change very little. There's a different kind of power that comes from organizing and really becoming engaged. You know, we took on an international fossil fuel company in this state. And if you really want to understand how power works in this country, that's a real good way to find out. And one of the things we learned is you have to be very well educated about the issues, and you have to be ready to act. One of our members is a president of the Farmers Union here in Nebraska, and he said activism is not like planting corn, where you go, throw a few seeds in the ground, and walk away. It's like milking cows. You do it every day, twice a day. And that's really what we've learned, is that we've stayed on top of things. We've known what was going on so that we could effectively deal with the actionable intelligence of the moment. But, you know, another thing I wanted to say, Betsy, about people's despair and people's lack of engagement in any meaningful sense. One of the things interesting that's gone on with this climate change debate is this country tends to go between in that debate, it's not happening or we can't prove it's happening on one extreme, to it's inevitable, so there's nothing we can do about it.
Oh, that is
without
one of my
ever stopping in the middle, without
yep.
ever stopping in the middle where we say, people can actually do a great deal about this, but they have to get together in living rooms all over this country and start talking. And so that's really what the group Green Boat is an attempt to do, to say, here is a way to really come into this as an active participant, as a person who believes in participatory democracy. Here are some ideas about how to genuinely participate in what's going to happen in your community around these issues.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you. It's like, where's that sweet spot in the middle between problem what problem to, oh, too late, you know.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
That's a uniquely American trend, and I don't understand that psychologically. Maybe you do, but we just have a couple minutes left, and I just want to ask you, you know, it seems sometimes like we are headed towards some kind of ecocide, especially if we don't wake up and smell the carbon soon. What gives you hope every day that, you know, we actually can slow this down, turn this around enough to make a difference for our grandchildren and beyond?
Well, you know, first of all, nobody knows what time it is. I mean, we may be at the end of the hominid era, or we may be at the beginning of a new, very transcendent era when human beings relate to each other and all living beings in the planet in a very different way. And nobody knows really what will happen next, including myself. But my argument in the Green Boat is essentially a mental health argument, which is, if we act in a meaningful and hopeful way to do that which we think is important, we will have happier lives, and we may be able to actually succeed in doing what needs to be done. You know, some days I'm like everyone else. Some days I'm gloomier about this situation than others. But one thing I want to say about hope is this situation could change very radically if people all over the planet work in their individual communities to raise awareness and protect that which is nearby. We could have an enormous change very quickly in how this world operates. And the other thing is, this isn't kind of a pie-in-the-sky fantasy. You know, Paul Hawkins documented some time ago, about 6 years ago, that there were 2 million groups working in the world to do things to avert global climate change. There's a lot of people intensely engaged all over the world in making things better. The biggest problem is not actually, in my opinion, lack of civic engagement. It's that we don't know about each other.
Ah.
For example, one thing that happens to me, everywhere
I go, we just have 1 minute left. Make it quick, Mary.
To speak, people say, well, here's what we're doing in our town. I wish we had some kind of worldwide echo net that could connect all of us who are working together.
I'm working on that.
So
that's
wonderful.
My dream, the Green Net.
Well,
News
that's
Network,
wonderful,
you know?
Betsy. Good luck with that.
Thank you, and thank you for giving all of us hope. And it's a fabulous book. I highly recommend it right about now, The Green Boat, by the wonderful Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. That does it for this edition of the program. Hope you've enjoyed it. If you want to catch the archives, go to www.thegreenfront.com or prn.fm. Have a great green week.